Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Outdoor Equestrian Podcast. I'm your host, Remy Kelville, and today I'm going to interview a woman named Maggie. She is an Appalachian Trail thru-hiker, a freelance writer, and managing editor for thetrek.co. She spends her time shooting archery, backpacking, and climbing with various other outdoor activities. Her recent articles and editorial projects can be found at her website in the description, and she has been a REI member since 2010. Yeah, a lot of stuff going on. But other than that, she almost died in a whitewater kayaking accident, and I get to talk with her about her near-death experience. It's very interesting. Let's get started.
Hi, this is Maggie.
Hi, Maggie. This is Remy.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Are you French?
No. Well, my mom is, so I guess I'm half French, yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay, yeah, the name sounds French.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I just saw your questions, so we can just get into it if you want.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to do this.
Absolutely. I'm more than happy to.
So, I know that you're a freelance writer and you write articles about the outdoors.
Yes.
I also know that you hiked the Appalachian Trail, so tell me about how you got into the outdoors and how you prepared for a thru-hike like the Appalachian Trail.
I got into the outdoors in high school, late high school, early college. I grew up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, or about an hour south of there, and my dad took me hiking, and I hated it because I thought it was pointless. You just go up a mountain and then go back down. Mm-hmm. There was no reward. And so I think it took me a couple years of being dragged into the whites in New Hampshire to really understand that the process of hiking is the reward. And you go back to your car and you go home at the end of the day, but you have to enjoy the process of actually being out there. And so I got into it there in New Hampshire, and then I moved out west after college. I lived in national parks for a few years as a horseback tour guide.
Oh,
and
nice.
Then moved to Montana, where I got more into the outdoors, into backcountry travel on bikes, with climbing, with kayaking. I started hunting. I got more into backpacking and trail running. And then I hiked the AT in 2015, which was a hell of a long time ago now. And yeah, it had kind of always been a goal of mine. I didn't really prepare at all. I did the basic research. I wound up with a 50-pound pack. Didn't have any idea about the ultralight ethos or the idea of shaving weight or how to get in shape for something. So I didn't get in shape. I just gained a bunch of weight because I figured I'd be hiking it all off, and then started the AT and didn't do a lot of planning, and it was totally fine.
Yeah, that is so cool. So you didn't know a lot about backpacking before the AT.
No, I think I'd been on like 2 overnight hikes in my entire life.
Okay. Really cool. And you said your dad pulled you into to go hiking with him, right?
Yeah, my dad was kind of my connection to the outdoors.
Okay.
Actually, there's 4 of us. I have 3 siblings. I'm the oldest. And no one else ended up enjoying the outdoors at all except me.
Huh.
And so, yeah, my dad's still the person that I connect with the most about hiking. He's a super avid hiker and a crazy talented athlete still living in New Hampshire. And so, yeah, the inspiration to move out west also kind of came from him to explore bigger mountains and the more open expanses and more public lands out here with better access, or different access, I guess, not better. And so, yeah, it definitely came from my dad and just kind of sprung this lifelong dedication to being outside as much as possible.
Yeah, definitely. I think the outdoors is so healing, too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds a lot like my family. They're not real outdoorsy, but I love it. And my dad, he would take me as a child to this land that he had up in Teller County, Colorado. And there was just tons of land that he had, and he would build a cabin with his friend. So I just liked going up there, liked hiking, and we would go fishing. So it was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, sounds kind of familiar. Sounds kind of like how I grew up.
Yeah. So what tips do you have for someone who is just starting out with backpacking, and what kind of gear would be good to invest in as a first-time backpacker?
I don't, let's see, if you're just getting into backpacking, I would say to start small. I wouldn't necessarily say go hike 2,000 miles with only having hiked overnight twice in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely, like, if you're not willing to really suffer, it's kind of a big kick in the face. But I'd say start out by doing a short overnight. Like, it could be a place that you've already hike to and done a day hike to, but carry a backpack out there. There's a huge difference between carrying a day pack and hiking and carrying, you know, 20 or 25 pounds or more on your back. And so kind of see, you have to adjust your mileage. You have to understand that everything's going to feel harder with a full pack on. Practice setting your tent up in your yard before you get out there. Get all your gear dialed in a pretty tame area before you try to take on something big. Because I think if you start out going too big too fast, you'll get overwhelmed and you might not enjoy the process as much. And let's see, for gear, I don't know if I recommend getting a full backpacking setup right when you start. See if someone has a sleeping bag you can borrow or a backpack. If you think that you like it, I recommend not getting the cheapest and heaviest items. I recommend, if you think that this is going to be something that you want to do, I recommend investing in better, lighter gear and really doing your research. A lot of times these big stores like Backcountry and REI, they have the most readily accessible gear, but it's not necessarily the best gear. And you might end up wanting to upgrade really quickly after buying your first setup. Like I spent probably $1,000 on my first setup just going to REI and buying everything that they had on the shelves. And I definitely wouldn't recommend that. I would recommend doing research into smaller brands that have lighter gear that's more durable, that isn't necessarily the first thing you're going to see on the big store shelves.
Okay. And then I know that you've been REI member since 2010. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Very good. Yep. That's when I first bought all my stuff. Yeah, I love REI. I write for REI. I'm a huge fan of what they do, and I partner with them with the website that I co-founded. But I also don't think that necessarily it's the only place to buy backpacking gear.
Okay. And then you said your dad was an athlete. Is that correct?
Yeah, he's an endurance athlete. And so I guess So he was a 100-mile, he ran 100-mile races when I was a kiddo growing up. He's doing all of the New Hampshire hiking lists. My boyfriend is an ultra-endurance athlete. I think I've just... It's the kind of personality that I like, I guess.
Yeah. And then your family, are they active besides being outdoors, or?
My mom rides horses. I see that you ride horses, and you have kind of a horse thing going on.
I do, yes.
I was a horseback guide in Yellowstone. I grew up riding hunter jumper.
And so
my mom rides horses, my dad hikes, and my siblings don't enjoy doing anything active except for my brother skis, and that's it.
Okay. So you're different than your family, but that's good though. That's
totally,
like me.
Yeah
I'm
they
very different.
What I do. They think I'm just like this weird person who runs around in the mountains for most of the year.
And I know that you climb too. I'm starting to do bouldering.
Oh, nice.
But I've yet to get outdoors, and I think it looks super fun, so I definitely want to try that.
Yeah, it's a whole other ball game.
Yeah, and I love skiing. And you said you grew up in New Hampshire, so were there skiing there that you did?
I actually learned to ski as an adult. And
okay.
It was the worst sport to learn as an adult. Everyone's been skiing since they could walk, and mm-hmm. I was 30 years old, not understanding how to put ski boots on, and just pizzaing down the bunny hill. It was a horrible experience that I wouldn't wish on anybody, but I think I'm getting better now. It's been 2 years.
Okay.
So. Yeah, I learned to ski just a couple years ago. My younger brother's a very good skier, but not me.
Oh, good. Okay. So with your dad running, being an endurance athlete, were you with him a lot, like running as well, growing up, or did it just start as a teenager that he would take you outdoors?
Yeah, I hated activity. So I was I filmed a pilot for a TV show over the summer, and they wanted photos of myself as a child outdoors, and my parents looked through these photo albums of me growing up, and they're like, Maggie, you hated being outside. There are no pictures of you outside. You were never outside. I was like sitting on the front porch eating ice cream. I hated running. I hated activity. It's uncomfortable. It's not super fun. It's rewarding, but you have to be a lot of times uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's hard to go up, and it hurts your knees to go down, and you can be out of breath, or sometimes it's cold or rainy, or you know. And as a kid, I just didn't enjoy being uncomfortable. I didn't see the point in it. So, no, I didn't do anything until like late high school, early college.
Okay, so when did that shift in your head, I guess, like from not wanting to being uncomfortable to really liking the outdoors?
I think I realized that the part of the discomfort was part of the, I guess, the experience of it. And I started thinking beyond the discomfort being the primary aspect of the activity and started appreciating actually being outdoors and having that be the primary aspect of it. So it was just a mindset shift. I wasn't like the most mature or tough child. I was kind of like a frail, weird kid who wore these plaid dresses with pilgrim socks. So, it was super strange. And so, yeah, I think just a mentality shift and growing up a little bit and experiencing more than just, what was right in front of my face. I drew a lot and read a lot as a kid. But yeah, just yeah, growing up, I guess.
Yeah, and then how did you get the opportunity to write for Backpacker Magazine and the freelance work that you do?
Oh man, dude, like freelancing is just rejection, rejection,
Yeah,
rejection.
it's tough.
I have this submittable list where I've submitted fiction writing to different journals, and I can scroll like three full pages of these rejection things, and then there's like one acceptance, and then it's three more pages of rejection. And so for Backpacker, I was working for the Trek as my full-time job, and they didn't want me to write for Backpacker because they saw it as competition. And so as soon as I left that job, I got laid off from COVID and went full-time freelance. I started pitching to Backpacker, and I probably pitched them for 6 months, and they hated everything I pitched. And then I pitched something that they liked, and that was it. And all it takes is one good article or one good essay, one good pitch that they like, and they think, okay, this is a writer that we could work with. And so they see your draft, they like working with you. So then they're more prone to look at your email when it comes in again. You say, hey, I have another idea. Can I write about this? And because they've already worked with you, it's a lot easier to get a foot in the door for subsequent pieces. But it's just a lot of rejection. It's a lot of sending ideas out that everybody hates, and then finally something gets accepted.
Yeah, well, it's good. It only takes one. So.
Yeah, but like I could. I have a piece coming out with Outside too that I've been pitching Outside for 4 years before they
Wow.
accepted from me. So yeah, mostly rejection.
Yeah. Well, you gotta start somewhere, I guess.
I get rejected all day. I get rejections every single day, even though they have better bylines than I ever have before. It's like, oh, they still hate all these ideas. That's fine. Whatever.
So I was reading one of your articles, and it was examining the connection between mental health and extreme endurance endeavors.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite pieces I've ever written. It was so hard to write. I am not a good researcher
Yeah.
and I'm not a good reporter.
I thought
But
that
it,
was
I
so
mean,
interesting.
thank you. Yeah, I really like that. And Sawyer, that company that I wrote it for, just for their site, they just gave me free rein with the subject so I could take it however long I wanted, which was forever. And just kind of take the topic wherever I wanted to go with it, which was really fun. So their editorial team didn't really care. They said, yeah, cool, come up with something interesting. So I tried to.
Yeah, and then I like how you started it with your friend, I believe. His name was Jeff.
Yeah, that's my boyfriend. Yep.
Okay. And he was hiking for 22 hours at a time, covering more than 50 miles a day, you said in the article. That's insane.
So Jeff's kind of thing is setting these records on long distance trails. So he broke the Colorado Trail record this year. He broke the Long Trail record
Wow.
last year, and the Arizona Trail record. He has goals for this year too. And being close to someone and watching them put themselves through absolute torment like that,
Yeah.
in the name of their activity was absolutely fascinating. It kind of got my wheels spinning. Like, why do people do this to themselves?
Yeah. That is amazing. And you asked yourself, from that experience, from watching him go through that, I think his
Yeah.
body was he was just his body was wearing down. So you asked yourself, why do people do this? Do people push themselves that close to the edge, and do they register higher for symptoms of depression or anxiety? So, what did you find in that research?
So I found that they do. And so let's see, I have another piece coming out with an REI co-op journal that talks about people who take bigger risks and push themselves really hard in the backcountry and how they have lower trait anxiety, which means that it takes more for them to feel things. And in this case, it kind of goes along with someone who's putting themselves through such a crazy ultra endurance feat. people who do these things, in from what I found from talking to clinical psychologists and people who assess risk, and also from reading way too many journal articles about it, is that these people who do ultra endurance endeavors also have a lowered, not self-preservation, but a lowered risk assessment for what they're putting their bodies through, and also have shown higher instances in depressive and anxiety traits. And so I think it made me wonder, just like in layman's terms, what are people like, do people like themselves who do this? Is this like kind of like this self-torture type thing that isn't necessary, but they still push themselves past what most people can?
Okay. That's so interesting.
It was fascinating, yeah.
So is it kind of like a healing thing? Did they go for it for
No, it's like an outlet. So
okay.
Because I think that people who are feeling these things, I know like for myself, I've been diagnosed with everything under the sun, from social anxiety to generalized anxiety to depression to like low end of the bipolar spectrum, absolutely everything. Like from the time I was a kid, my parents put me in some sort of therapy. They thought I was very broken. And I don't think that working hard in the outdoors and fitting yourself through things is a way to heal it or like a way to ignore it. But I think it's an outlet. And I think that it's kind of what I talked about in that article, is if you're feeling like very upset or very stressed about your life or some things in your life, and like they're like manifesting as anxiety or depression symptoms, and then you go do these things, you're like, you're still suffering in a way during the endurance event, but there's a reason for it and you can pinpoint why. And that suffering also has an end, which is like where that containment part of it comes from.
Okay.
So yeah, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's really cool. That had to be so interesting researching on.
Yeah, it was also hard because people that I'm really close to are doing this. Like watching Jeff put himself through that on the Colorado
Trail, yeah.
I'm thinking like, this isn't normal. Why doesn't he stop? This
yeah.
is insane. So it's really, it's been very interesting.
Yeah. So you said you suffered with mental health, and I know I do too. I suffer from depression. So is mental health something the outdoors has helped you with at all?
Yeah, definitely. It provides an outlet. It provides, you know, if you're feeling like a lot of built up anxiety or stress or pressure, and then you go work hard in the outdoors, you have that physical outlet. The outdoors has been shown to improve mood, improve concentration, improve the mental and physical manifestations of these depressive episodes. It's not a cure-all, obviously. There's like a combination of things. If you have like actual chemical imbalance, it's important that you seek medical help or talk therapy. But at the same time, I think being outside provides a sense of peace, a sense of purpose, an outlet. It's an activity to do. It's healthy. Exercise gives you endorphins. Like they said, Legally Blonde, endorphins make you happy. And so, yeah, there's plenty of benefits to it, but I do think that at a certain point, if something's really wrong, you know, with how you're interacting with the world, or something's very challenging for you, then you can't bank everything on being active in the outdoors.
Definitely. Do you think hiking the AT helped you a lot with your sense of self and your mental health in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, hiking the AT was, it was a purpose. And so, I mean, when people thru-hike something, they are hiking for, you know, anywhere from a few hundred miles to a few thousand miles.
Mm-hmm.
And for that amount of time, you have that very specific purpose. You're out there hiking, you're heading north. And so what it does is it gives you a reason to get up each day, when a lot of times in your day-to-day life, you know, you have a reason to get up, but a lot of times your goals are less defined in your day-to-day life. And so when you're through hiking, it's like really incredibly simple. You just have to get up and keep walking in the same direction that you're trying to go. And so I think what it does is it gives you, for that amount of time, a very easily attainable, not easily attainable, but an easily quantifiable goal.
Mm-hmm. And then getting into the outdoors more as adult and a teenager, did you have any daunting experiences in the outdoors?
I almost drowned in a kayak a couple of years ago.
Oh,
that was really?
Really
bad.
Wow.
Yeah. My worst experience, I think, in the outdoors actually was something I'm not super good at, obviously, which is whitewater kayaking. So got in a boat, got in the water I shouldn't have been in. I'd never been kayaking in a spray skirt before, and I flipped my boat and couldn't get out of my spray skirt. And
wow.
So I was underwater traveling down this rapid, like in the current. And yeah, I was trapped in my boat underwater, and I managed to get a couple of breaths, but couldn't flip over. And then I was unconscious and unresponsive by the time my friend ditched his boat and was able to swim to me and got me out of the boat. So that's the worst.
Oh my God. That's crazy. Yeah. So yeah, you didn't die, right? Like you were still.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I never coded. But yeah, I was unconscious and unresponsive. So the last thing I remember is feeling something hit my boat, and I think it was him. I don't know though, because by the time he flew me up out of the water, I wasn't breathing. So there you go. That's a good one.
Yeah. Wow. Because I know some people have near-death experiences, so
yes,
that's very interesting to me as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, what that does to your brain is really messed up. For months afterwards, I would forget that I hadn't died, because in my head, when I was underwater, I kept thinking, you know, you have to come to terms with the fact that you maybe have only another 2 minutes to live. And that does really weird things to your brain, because you think these are the last thoughts I'm ever going to have. Wow. And so that's like more of a final train of thought than anything you've ever done before, because when you're drowning, you have minutes to think about it. And you're very aware of what's going on. And so, I would forget. I'd be in like yoga class, or I'd be out with friends afterwards, like that summer. And I would think how sad it was that I died, even though I didn't. Because my brain had kind of gone there and accepted it, because I didn't think that he was going to get to me. I didn't know where he was. I didn't know if he was going to reach me in time, and I couldn't flip my boat. So, yeah, it's super messed up.
Wow.
Zero stars.
And was it just panic when you were underwater, or what did you think in that moment?
It's really sad. So I told myself that if I only had a few minutes left to be alive, I didn't want to spend them mad or panicking. And so it was like two trains of thought. The first one was physical, like try to roll, please, like try to roll, try to pull your skirt, try to roll. And the second train of thought was like just this deep regret and sadness. My dad had just been diagnosed with cancer. I felt bad for my family. Oh, wow. I thought, like, you know, like all the things that you think about, like who's going to take care of my cat? Like,
yeah.
I left my roommate home with the cat, like all these things, like I'm so sorry for my family. Like, yeah. And then at the same time, like, then you're like, okay, snap out of it. Try to roll your boat again. Like, you have to get a breath, even though, like, you know, it's impossible at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't, you're stuck. So yeah, I told myself not to panic and not to be mad, because I didn't want to spend my last couple minutes alive panicking.
Wow. So, that's a crazy experience.
Yeah. That's the story that's coming out with REI, hopefully at some point. It was supposed to come out last year, right before the pandemic hit, but they wanted to wait until there wasn't so much in the news cycle to publish it. So
yeah,
at some point that'll be out.
Oh yeah, you should show me that when it's published. I'd love to read that.
Oh, I can't believe you wrote on my writing. It's like so flattering.
Yeah.
But yes, I'll definitely send it over. I'm very excited about this one. So that's where I did a lot of that research and reporting for people like me who take pretty stupid risks in the backcountry. I'm like, why are people like this? Why do I do this?
Uh-huh.
And so that was kind of the basis of that article.
Wow.
I don't know why I keep doing these research articles. They're so hard, and they're not like my forte.
They are hard, but at the same time, I really like to learn about different topics, so it's interesting.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. So during when you were drowning, it's amazing that you, you know, came back from that. I mean, that is incredible. I can't imagine what I would think during that time. But have you been back in the water since then, kayaking, or?
Not in a spray skirt, and, you know, I'm, like, full of bravado, and I want everyone to think I'm super tough and brave,
mm-hmm.
And so after that happened, I told everyone, like, oh, yeah, I'll get back in the kayak, I don't care, it's gonna, like, I had to recover, obviously, I was sick afterwards, my body had been through trauma,
mm-hmm.
But I kept thinking, like, oh, yeah, I'll take a roll clinic, I'll, like, learn how to roll a boat and do it right, and I never did, and so, like, I have two kayaks, and they've never been out in whitewater since then,
mm-hmm.
And I keep thinking, like, this year I'm going to, yeah, but for some reason, like, that was just, like, I have a huge mental block on it. It took me a really long time to be able to put my face in the water.
Yeah.
I kept my face out of the water when I was showering. The sound of water and the sound of things changing from quiet to noisy would send me into a panic, because when I rolled my boat, it went from loud to silent.
Wow.
And so I couldn't handle, like, hearing doors close, like, on crowds of people. If I went outside, hearing like it going from loud to quiet made me panic. It was like really messed me up, actually.
Wow. So it was kind of like a, would you say like a kind of post-traumatic stress?
I think so, yep. And so I talked to a few clinical therapists and like adventure sports researchers about this.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that I was experiencing PTSD, especially like my aversion to like things going from loud to quiet. And also the fact that like I would forget that I hadn't died and just get really sad all of a sudden thinking I had.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I haven't talked about this in a while since I wrote that article actually. So this is really interesting.
Yeah.
It sucked.
Wow.
I did not like it. Wow. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you're here. you're living, so that's good. On a happier note, though, tell me about some of your favorite articles you've written and why they are your favorite.
So this REI feature, if it ever comes out, is definitely one of my favorites because
mm-hmm.
I took this deeply personal, traumatizing experience that I never think about anymore, apparently, and researched around it because I had these questions about my own personality traits and why I take so many risks. Oh. And I was able to do research in the name of an article and write a combination of research, reporting, and a narrative. That was kind of a big step for me for usually writing, like, gear reviews like I'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
So if that ever publishes, that's one of them. And then I really like that Sawyer piece, the research-reported one, about mental health and endurance athletes. And I think it's the ones that are the hardest to do for me, like the ones that involve research and interviews and reporting, end up being my favorites because they don't come naturally to me. It takes me a really long time to put them together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not confident at all when I start them that I can pull it off. And then when I do, I'm always happy with the results. So I think it's working harder. I always regret accepting them when I get assigned. But I am always happy with how they turn out.
Yeah. Amazing. And then where do you think you would like to write for? Like what kind of media organizations do you have in mind, or do you have any in mind so far?
Yeah, so let's see. I got into my three goals for 2021 was Backpacker Magazine, Outside, and Huffington Post, and I already got into all of them by the end of the first month of the year.
Wow.
So that was like that was awesome. So I was really happy about that. I think right now I'm working on an essay about drawing with my brother during COVID and how we reconnected over FaceTime to draw together. And so I'm going to pitch that to the New York Times, which is a super lofty goal.
Oh, wow.
But why not just shoot for the stars?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to write more personal essays outside of the outdoor industry.
That's incredible. Have you ever thought of writing for, like, pitching for National Geographic?
Yeah, I think so. I don't do as much exploratory work. And so I think in the outdoor industry, kind of like my backcountry research, actually, I have this really interesting lead poisoning pitch out right now that I sent to Outside that I haven't answered. And so if Outside doesn't want it, I might. Nat Geo just seems so lofty to me. Like their editorial standards, I think I'd be absolutely terrified of how in-depth their standards go. And I think I could pull it off, but it's definitely like that would be a huge commitment to be assigned something with Nat Geo.
Yeah, that would be amazing though.
It'd be super cool. Now
yeah.
You have me thinking. Why not try?
So tell me about the lead piece you were talking about.
So I am friends with a couple people who work at this state-run wildlife rehab center in Montana.
Hmm.
And they're telling me about the proliferation of lead poisoning in raptors in the past couple years in Montana because our snowpack is so much lower that hunters who use lead core bullets, the carcasses have fragments of lead in them, and they're left out for longer because there's not as much snow in Montana as there used to be. And so the raptors feed on these carcasses that have been poisoned with lead fragments, and they get sick. And a raptor who has been poisoned by lead dies an absolutely horrific death. And it ends up being like this weirdly political issue because sometimes the hunting industry will see it as a slight against them. And a lot of our public lands, the money to manage and protect the public lands comes from hunters' fees. You know, hikers, backpackers, mountain bikers don't really pay anything to use the public lands, but hunters do. And so regulating the hunting industry with the materials that they can use in the bullets ends up being a political issue, even though these birds are being poisoned at a horrifyingly high rate, especially in recent years with our lower snowpack. And so I pitched an investigative reporting piece about that to see, like, politically, how is this a political issue when it's impacting the ecosystem as badly as it is? So that's my latest idea. No one's attempted it yet, but I'm super stoked on it.
Oh, no, that sounds so interesting. Someone has to accept that. Yeah.
I hope so. So if outside my first choice, and if they don't want it, I have a few other options. But yeah, so I had to wait until my editorial schedule kind of calmed down before I could commit to pitching. Because if that gets assigned, that would be a huge workload for me. and so I have to kind of see, like, where I'm at with my workload and in the upcoming months to see how much I want to pitch. Because if these things get assigned, it's super exciting, but it also means a lot of work on my end. So I have to wait until I, like, kind of submit a bunch of higher effort pieces, and then I can go from there and start pitching again.
Wow.
Gotta manage your time. I gotta have some sort of work-life balance.
Oh, yeah. So what else do you do besides riding in the outdoors?
I ride horses.
Oh, yeah, you're a horse girl. Yeah. That's so cool.
I'm a washed-up horse girl. So I grew up with Morgans on the East Coast. And, now I ride horses for friends. My friend, I actually have a feature coming out in a National Guiding Journal. My friend owns the only female-owned outfitter in Yellowstone, and so I ride with her.
Wow.
She's got these big half drops that I ride. And, let's see. I like to read, and I like to do puzzles, and I like to dress my cat up in creepy children's clothing. I like to draw, so I draw with my brother once a week on FaceTime. Big animal canvases, big animal person. And, yeah, what kind of riding do you do, by the way?
Oh, I do everything. I just started, like, I worked for the yearbook in high school, so I started interviewing people there, and it's just, it just started a passion for me. And I love the outdoors, so I do a lot of outdoor riding, and I like horses. So basically it's just horses and the outdoors, and I've done, like, feature riding, for people at CSU. At my school, because Colorado State University is huge in the outdoors, and they have ice climbers, which I've never done, but I just think that's so cool, and I've interviewed people who do that, and it's a lot of fun.
That's awesome. And then do you ride Western or English?
I ride English. So I did jumping in high school.
Okay.
I can't say I'm very good. I did verticals and cross rails. So I'm a little beginner, but, you know, it's fun. I grew up, I started riding horses at 4, and my dad would take me to this ranch up in Salida, Colorado, and we would go, and that's where my passion started.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I grew up, doing hunter jumper in New Hampshire.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so fun. I don't think,
I agree.
If you're not a horse person, you can't really understand the love for it.
It's a connection that you don't have with any other animal.
Yeah,
it is. And I'm trying to, like, once I'm done, like, doing all of my other things, I haven't had a horse in so long, but eventually I'm definitely going to have my own horse again and start investing in the horse world.
Yeah, so fun. That's a dream for me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Maggie.
Absolutely. It was lovely chatting with you. Good luck with the episode. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah. Do you have any other closing thoughts?
No. It's just been really nice to talk about writing and not just backpedaling, which everybody always asks me about. So thanks for asking me about, like, writing, because it's so fun to talk about.
Oh, yeah. No problem. You're welcome.
Yeah. I'm impressed with how in-depth you are. So have a great time. It was great chatting.
Yeah. You too.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. All right, guys, that was my interview with Maggie. That was cool. I really appreciate people who, she didn't grow up too outdoorsy, but then she just got into it. And I just think that's so interesting because that was kind of like me, you know? I definitely grew up in Colorado, but I wasn't as outdoorsy as the people in my class. And, I just... I don't know, I just found the love when I became a teenager, and I just looked at it differently than I did when I was a kid. And that's just something that I'll carry with throughout my life. So I thank you guys so much for being a part of the Outdoor Equestrian Podcast, and I can't wait for the next interview with Kinga Phillips. I'm super excited. Thank you.